This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We've already heard some scary words about swine flu. Yesterday, Department of Homeland Security head Janet Napolitano declared a public health emergency. The Centers for Disease Control doubled the number of confirmed cases in the United States to 40, with 20 more cases in New York City, as well as isolated cases in California, Texas, Kansas, and Ohio. The number believed killed by swine flu in Mexico is up near 150. The U.S. warns travelers to Mexico. The European Union warns travelers to the United States, and we may yet hear the scary news that the world has entered a flu pandemic. Yet so far, all of the cases in this country are believed to be non-life-threatening. Drugs that treat the flu appear to be effective, and work is already underway to develop a vaccine. Later in the program, a playwright makes his point about torture in a brilliantly reviewed new comedy. Christopher Durang will join us. But first, questions and answers about swine flu. Our phone number, 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org. And you can join the conversation at our website. Go to npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. NPR science correspondent Richard Knox joins us now from his office in Boston. And Dick, thanks very much for joining us.
You're welcome.
And the latest news, 40 confirmed cases in the United States. So I know there's a briefings this afternoon. What have we learned?
We have nonstop briefings and briefings competing with briefings. Well, today we've learned not a whole lot. The 40 cases, which is, looks like a doubling, and it is a doubling in numbers from yesterday, really it is all attributable to 20 cases that have been confirmed out of this New York City high school outbreak. It doesn't represent that the disease is continuing to spread rapidly there. What it just represents is that they've continued to test, and they've continued to get test results back. And so now, instead of 8 students at that school, there are 28 people, students, and possibly others. We don't have a lot of detail on just who those 28 are, but they're all related to that one school, and we'll probably see some more as more test results come in.
And in terms of the spread, that's limited news and thus far so good. Why are cases in this country relatively mild as compared to the situation in Mexico?
Oh, that is like the question on lots of public health people's minds right now. And they just don't have an answer yet. It's really quite odd that we've seen significant, really serious disease. I mean, hundreds of people hospitalized with pneumonia and respiratory distress in Mexico. We haven't seen anybody like that in Massachusetts. That's where I live, so in the United States at all. There's one brief hospitalization, but no really serious life-threatening illnesses. The public health people are saying, well, that's because we really haven't seen many cases, and you know, we should be prepared to see serious cases because people react differently, and we don't know what factors are involved in the ones in Mexico. So they're sort of preparing us to see those, but fortunately we haven't. But they need to understand why not.
And is this a new strain of swine flu? We've heard about this in years past, and lately we've all been worried about avian flu.
Yeah, it absolutely is a new strain of flu. I mean, there's a debate brewing now about whether it ought to be called swine flu because, in fact, it has genetic elements of human flu. It has genetic elements of flu that infects pigs, both North American pigs and Asian pigs, two different kinds of strains, and it has bird flu elements. So it's a quadruple reassortant, as the scientists say, and that's very unusual. I don't think it's unprecedented, but it definitely is a new thing, this particular strain, and that's one reason it's why it's worrisome, because nobody in the world has been exposed to it before. The 1976 strain of swine flu is undoubtedly different. I mean, even though they're both being called swine flu, you know, one of the things that we have to really keep in mind about influenza viruses is that they constantly change. And so a 1976 virus is just bound to be real different from the one today. I mean, genetically and the kind of disease it causes or doesn't cause and so on.
So if this is new, then the protections afforded by those flu vaccines that we all took last winter, they would not necessarily protect us.
No, they're saying now that the current seasonal flu vaccine shouldn't be relied on to protect anybody. And that's they had hoped that it might provide some protection because this new strain is called H1N1. That's the way flu viruses are typed. And in fact, the current seasonal vaccine flu contains a component against an H1N1. But this one is different enough from the seasonal vaccine a component that it doesn't provide any protection, they think.
So that's the concern. If it does start spreading, it can spread rapidly, and nobody's protected against it.
It could spread rapidly. No, I think we have to, you know, we don't know how rapidly it's spreading, and that's probably the other big question, along with why we see different kinds of seriousness of disease. The New York outbreak at the St. Francis Preparatory School, which apparently was touched off by some kids who came, you know, went to Mexico and came back with the virus, is the one that might teach us most about how rapidly it might spread and how many generations of infection it might cause. In other words, presumably some of those kids got the virus from somebody in Mexico, so that's generation one. Some of those kids may have transmitted it to their fellow students when they got back home. That's generation two. We need to know whether some of those second-generation people passed it on to somebody else. That would be generation three. And those are the kinds of things that really determine how transmissible it's going to be and whether it just dies out after one or two, which some flu viruses do, or whether it keeps going.
Let's get some callers in on the conversation. 800-989-8255, email talk@npr.org, and let's begin with Al. Al calling us from Minneapolis.
Hello.
Hi, Al. Go ahead, please.
I'm just wondering, I understand that we need to be more prepared, and we probably need to test that preparedness for outbreaks of certain things, but it seems like we're crying wolf just a few too many times. I encounter a lot of skepticism and a lot of people rolling their eyes, another outbreak, another SARS, another avian flu, another swine flu that just absolutely goes nowhere. And
I'm sure you're worried about crying wolf and not rooting for something that would kill millions of people, Al. But let's get a response from Richard Knox.
I think that's a really important point, and I've been thinking about it a lot, too. There's a really difficult line to walk if you're a public health person whose job it is to try to head things off and find things early and do everything you can to minimize an emerging problem. The really fine line or difficult line between preparedness and communication about what might happen and raising false alarm, you know, crying wolf. And I don't think there's a really perfect answer to that. I do know, and I can say, having covered this for some years now, that the avian flu H5N1 virus really was taken very seriously by people around the world, scientists who know, and they weren't just, you know, trying to scare us or get research dollars merely. And it turned out that, it, at least from what we know so far, having watched it for years, it hasn't acquired the capacity to transmit efficiently from human to human to human. This one looks different so far because, you know, we've seen with this one, this new swine flu virus or whatever we want to call it, is different from H5N1 that we've been watching so long. We have clusters and we have cases breaking out in various parts of the country, although sporadic so far. And we have whatever's going on in Mexico. We don't clearly understand what's going on in Mexico, but it's a big thing, whatever it is. So I think that it's totally justified. You know, people, you know, need to be skeptical about everything these days, but I think it's totally justified to take these warnings seriously. And I think that's what the federal government, you know, today from President Obama on down to everybody else is trying to convey. You know, we really have to watch this one. We have to be ready. You know, there was an interesting statement today from the acting director of the CDC. It's not too early to think how you might care for your kids if your schools in your area got dismissed. Now, no, that's not here. It may not be here, but you know, it's not too early to think about how you would manage it.
Just to point out, schools in Mexico have been closed until at least May 5th. So,
and some in Texas.
Yes.
So, you know, that we could see that in the next few weeks. We don't know, but it's not too early to think about how you'd manage.
Al, thanks very much for the call. Here's an email from Chris in St. Paul. What is the working definition of pandemic? How is it different from epidemic? Can a pandemic contain epidemics? When does an illness become an epidemic, and when does it become a pandemic?
Well, let's see. I'll try to be concise here. An outbreak, which is sort of the beginning stages, and that's where we are now, as we have a bunch of outbreaks, really is a focal occurrence of a disease. Focal means in a given spot. An epidemic is when you have outbreaks that begin to spread and continue to spread and widen out over an area. A pandemic, really, I think you should think of as, you know, pan means across, and Demos means people. So, I mean, it means across peoples. And we think of a pandemic as a disease phenomenon that really sweeps across international borders and is found in vastly different parts of the world. One of the reasons why we're worried about this one is because we now have confirmed cases in four countries. Those four countries are all North Americans. Three are North American, one's Spain. There's some recent suggestion, not quite confirmed yet. I don't think that maybe Scotland has a couple of cases. People came back from Mexico. New Zealand, kids who visited Mexico, those are, we don't know for sure yet. And so that's another kind of little element in the alarm that's being raised here. This may begin to look like a pandemic, but it isn't yet.
And just a quick question by email from Eric in South Ogden, Utah. Do we have to worry about living animals, birds, swine, etc., transferring this disease across regions or across borders?
Don't think so. I mean, I think we would really love to know more about whether there are any animals out there, maybe especially pigs, that are suffering from flu outbreaks, maybe in Mexico, or, I think we're going to find out more, but we don't know that yet, as far as I know. I don't think that there's any reason at all to think that people are getting this directly from animals. I have to say that in the past, maybe 12 people a year have gotten a pig flu virus from a pig. They had exposure to pigs. But that just stopped there. And this is different because it seems to be sustaining in humans. But I don't think we ought to blame the animals for any kind of ongoing problem at the moment.
Richard Knox, we'll let you get back to those endless briefings. We know there are more coming up later today. Thanks very much for your time today. Appreciate it.
You're welcome. Anytime, Neil.
NPR Health and Science correspondent Richard Knox with us from his home office in Boston. Coming up, Dr. Kathleen Neusel will take your questions on the swine flu outbreak. She is among the world's experts. Give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. Stay with us. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We know you've got questions about swine flu. We've got at least some of the answers. When we don't have the answers, we'll tell you we don't. Give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. There's a conversation underway at our website as well. That's at npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. And now for more of those answers, we turn to Dr. Kathleen Neusel, who chairs the Influenza Working Group of the CDC Advisory Committee on Immunizations Practices. And Dr. Neusel joins us from her offices in Seattle. We know that there's stuff going on all day today. We appreciate your time.
Yes, thanks, Neil. I'm happy to be here to answer questions.
And do you agree with Richard Knox's conclusion that this is something to worry seriously about?
You know, I do. I think he laid out the issues very nicely. I think it's important to remember that we're fairly new in understanding what's happening here. It was really only a week ago that we heard about the first two cases in California. We've learned a lot since then. I think we'll continue to learn a lot over the next 2 to 3 days, over the next week. And based on what we learned, we can make evidence-based decisions on the best guidance and how concerned we should be.
Here's a question from Wilhelmina in West Olive, Michigan. Can your guest please explain why young adults seem to be more susceptible to this current flu and why some experts say this fact makes the strain more alarming?
Well, again, I think it may be too soon to say that young adults are more susceptible here. There may be some bias in who's being tested and in who's going to the doctor or who's being recognized. So I think at this point it is a little too early to know. We always worry when otherwise young, healthy people get sick. But again, I think we'll learn a lot in the coming days with the increasing investigation in Mexico about the age distribution of this illness.
On the phone with us now from Chicago is Molly. Molly, you there?
Yes, I'm here.
You're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Well, I just called my 32-year-old daughter this morning, and she is in bed with the flu, and she has a 5-year-old daughter in Chicago public school system. Should she be taken by a family member to a doctor to test and see if this is the swine flu or if it's a different strain?
And when you say she's got the flu, or a cough, a fever, that sort of thing?
In her congestion, upper congestion, and vomiting and weakness.
Dr. Neusel?
Yeah, so the primary symptoms of this swine flu, what we know so far, are similar to typical human influenza, which generally is high fever and cough, sometimes headache or muscle aches, and this swine influenza does appear to have a component of nausea or diarrhea. I think with individual patients, it is best probably for her to start with a phone call to her doctor or her healthcare provider and describe the symptoms and let the individual physician make a decision there.
All right, I'll advise that. I just wanted her to protect other family members and.
No, absolutely. And that's why I think a phone call is best. It may save her a trip or it may save exposure to other people.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
We wish her the best, Molly.
Thank you.
And in terms of treatment, Tamiflu, that, of course, only treats people who have already developed flu. It's not a vaccine. But has Tamiflu been proven effective against this strain of swine flu?
Well, that's an important point and something that hadn't been brought up earlier, that, yes, this strain of swine flu is susceptible to what we call neuraminidase inhibitors, which is Tamiflu or oseltamivir is the generic name, or zanamivir, which is an inhaled medication. And it appears to be susceptible both for treatment but also for prevention. So the CDC on their website does have clear guidelines. I know in the New York City school outbreak, they're using these guidelines to give these medications to people who are close contacts of those persons with swine influenza to prevent them from getting influenza.
Let's go to Barbie. Barbie with us from Choctaw, Arizona.
Yes, it's Choctaw, Arkansas.
I apologize.
The efficacy of gloves and surgical masks. We see them in Japan and China on TV. Should we be thinking about wearing those, especially if we're traveling? And if so, what kinds of cloth or paper masks? What do you recommend? Or are they just not effective against viruses?
Seeing a lot of masks in Mexico, too.
Yes.
Yes, really, really great questions that you're asking and really some difficult answers. What we do know is the simple measures that prevent transmission of any virus make a lot of sense. You know, frequent hand washing or use of alcohol gels, covering mouths when you cough, et cetera. The CDC hasn't put out any wide-scale recommendations on masks at present. We don't fully understand right now how this particular virus is transmitted. Most flu viruses, though, the way the mask works actually is that it keeps you from taking your hand and touching it to your nose or touching it to your mouth. So rather than being spread widely through the air, it's actually spread through close contact, and the CDC has defined that as within 6 feet, so really close contact. So at the moment, certainly there's no recommendation in the United States for widespread use of masks.
Barbie, thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, good question.
Email from Lori in Louisville. As an emergency physician, we send flu swabs regularly. If a swab comes back negative, does that mean that swine flu is ruled out entirely?
That's an excellent question. Again, it really depends on the type of diagnostic test that's being used in the individual hospital or health department. Most health departments actually will be able to pick this up, but they won't be. They will know that it's an influenza A, and then they'll have to send it on for more testing. But there could be some rapid diagnostic tests that are used in doctors' offices or in certain hospitals that may or may not pick this up. So I think at this point, it's best to work through your local or state health department, if you're in a physician's office or at a hospital, to be sure that the test you have can pick up this type of virus.
Let's go to Tony. Tony with us from Binghamton in New York.
Hi. Well, I'm a respiratory therapist, and I've been working in the field for well over 20 years. And I remember back when we had the SARS epidemic and the impact it had in our hospital then, although we didn't have any SARS cases, the emergency room was pretty much packed 24 hours a day with people coming in who developed a cough, a fever, and being understaffed already and having the current state of the economy, people losing their insurance, I can just see this whole thing happening all over again, people getting very concerned and starting to panic and overrun the emergency rooms again and tax an already taxed health system.
Yeah, I think at this point, you know, that's a very good point. I also was doing infection control during the SARS epidemic, and it does become difficult to know what to tell patients or people who think they may be patients may have flu and are concerned about it. I think one important message to remember here is that the cases so far in the United States have been mild cases, and that's good news. And as I told the earlier caller, to encourage people who have mild illness and don't have other medical illnesses, so otherwise healthy people, to perhaps make a phone call first. Now, if somebody has other high-risk conditions, you know, people with cancer or very elderly people or infants, then we're always more concerned about those populations. But a healthy person with mild illness does not need to go to the emergency room and may start with a phone call to a health care provider.
Right. I'm glad you said that. Because we've had people now who don't have any health insurance and don't even go to their doctors first because they will come to the emergency room first because they don't have a copay then.
Right. Right.
So we're, you know, I'm kind of concerned about being inundated by this, but I'm glad you said that about them calling first.
Tony, good luck.
Thanks.
Bye-bye. Here's an email from Mary Ann in Salem, Oregon. I live in Oregon, a state so far not reporting any cases of this flu. I am currently recovering from what was either a bad cold or a relatively mild case of flu. Last week I had all the symptoms given for this flu. Should I call my doctor as a public service in case this was a case of this virus, or should I just assume that it's something else and be glad I didn't get sicker?
That's a very good question. Again, you know, we are at the tail end of the regular influenza season, and of course there are many other viruses that can cause similar symptoms. So I would say at this point there are not easy tests that could be done to determine which of many viruses that she may have had. I think rather it's best for people who going forward become sick to be sure they contact their doctor if they have the symptoms that I explained. But I think if it was last week, we believe that the infectious period is probably a day before symptoms start through about 7 days after that first date of symptom is the current CDC guidance.
Let's talk with Doug, and Doug's with us from Randolph, Massachusetts.
Hey, Neil, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm curious about, let's see. Yesterday morning, the night before last, my wife and daughter and I flew back to Boston from California, and it was a red eye overnight. At the beginning of the flight, the people in the road immediately behind us were fine. They were conversational, asymptomatic. By halfway through the flight, they were sneezing and coughing, and towards the end of the flight, they were really having a rough time breathing with spasmodic coughing. I got off the flight, and I called the CDC and the Massachusetts Public Health Department and was, you know, basically shined on. And I'm wondering, finally I was able to reach somebody in the Massachusetts Department, one of the branches, who said, well, you know, when the old governor was here, Mitt Romney, cut a lot of the funding, and so we're letting people go left, right, and center, and we don't have anybody to follow up on that.
Is that something that he's concerned should be followed up upon, Dr. Newsom?
Well, again, I think it's very difficult to take in individual cases. If you look at all the viruses and the respiratory illness. You know, if you look at children, for example, in the course of a year, most children will have between one and three upper respiratory illnesses, and we have 40 cases of swine flu right now in the United States. So there's going to be a lot of background illness out there. On the other hand, it's this type of early detection and being attuned to this that allows public health officials to track it and see how serious it is. So it's really weighing that balance. What I hear in that message is it is absolutely important for this and for future public health concerns that we maintain our public health infrastructure, that we do take infectious disease threats very seriously, and that we have a robust public health response in the United States. So that funding is important, and I think we see in California a week or two ago how important it was, how absolutely important it was that somebody was astute enough to do further testing on the two cases.
Doug, there were similar people on my flight from Los Angeles to Baltimore, so we'll all go together. Bye-bye.
All right, bye-bye. Thank you.
We're taking questions and delivering what answers we can about swine flu. Our guest is Dr. Kathleen Neusel, who chairs the Influenza Working Group of the CDC Advisory Committee on Immunizations Practices, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. John's with us. John calling from Grand Junction, Colorado.
Yes.
Hi there.
Hi, Neil. The reason I'm calling is my son is going to be the best man at a wedding. It's just south of Cancun, and he and a party of about 40 have chartered a plane, you know, rented, you know, a hotel for the week, and they're all heading down there, leaving on Friday. So obviously I was calling to see if there was any reason for concern about that.
Health and Human Services Department is talking about non-essential travel to Mexico. You ought to think twice about it. But, Dr. Neusel, obviously people have made a lot of expensive arrangements for weddings way in advance. Is this essential?
Yeah, again, I don't think that's for me to decide. I would like to echo what you said. There is a travel advisory. People can keep up with these travel advisories and how they're changing on the website, and I think that is the best advice to follow. And I would also alert people that the CDC website, www.cdc.gov, is updated regularly, multiple times per day. And again, this is a new situation. It's changing fast. I think we need to be prepared to keep up with changing recommendations.
I think John's question was, if it was your son, would you tell him to go?
And again, I think that's I really think that's an individual decision to make, and we should follow the travel advisory,
which says at the moment don't go.
Exactly.
Okay, there, John, you got an answer.
I got an answer. All right. I don't know if he's going to like it, but we got an answer.
All right. Here's an email question from Judith in Sacramento. How are different types of flu recognized in the laboratory? Is it by spectroscopic patterns, or can different shapes be seen under a microscope?
Yes, what they do, for example, at the CDC lab is actually influenza virus has eight different parts, eight different genes, and they actually sequence the genes. It's a molecular technique. It's actually a little bit difficult to explain on the phone, but they can get down to, it's not microscopic, they can get down to a very fine level of detail in determining the virus and determining how the virus is related to other viruses. And if you were listening from the beginning of the program, determining actually how many different viruses combine to make a new virus. You know, so a piece of this virus is from a pig virus, you know, another part of this virus is from a human virus. So they can get down to, again, that actually map out the sequence of each individual gene.
So there's not going to be a great scene. Bill, come over. You got to look at this.
No.
Okay. Dr. Neusel, again, we know it's a very busy day for you. We appreciate your time.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Kathleen Neusel chairs the Influenza Working Group of the CDC Advisory Committee on Immunizations Practices and directs the Influenza Vaccine Project at PATH, a nonprofit group focused on global health. And she joined us today on the phone from her office in Seattle. Joining us in shortly after a short break is Christopher Durang, and he's going to be with us to talk about his new comedy about torture. I'm Neil Conan. Stay with us. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.